excuse the interruption. Before we get into this episode, I just wanted to take a moment to acknowledge that there's a lot going on right now with the COVID virus that's going around and all the anxiety that surrounds that. And there is no mention of any of that in this episode because it was recorded before all of this has happened. And I wanted to take a moment to say that we sincerely hope everybody's well and enduring this really dramatic time well. And our hearts and prayers are with you. And here is the episode.
This is Room in the Trees, a podcast about living a creative life. Room in the Trees is hosted by Trent Reynolds and me, Sabrina Ward Harrison.
Show notes, including pictures, links, video, and more for every episode can be found at roominthetrees.com.
You can follow us on Instagram at Sabrina Ward Harrison and at Trent Reynolds Art. And now, here's this week's episode.
Let me tell you something to be positive about. Actually, I just wanted to tell you. I don't know if it's something to be positive about. But Laura, my...
Your wonderful wife.
Wonderful wife and partner in crime and all of the above. She, and she's done this before, but she took the kids to Disneyland by herself.
And that's four kids.
That is four kids, including a two-year-old at Disneyland.
Whoa.
Just herself. So this is the second time she's done it. And I can't believe she did it the first time. But anyway, just wanted to throw that out there. Laura, dynamite gal.
Yes.
Not afraid.
No, she's so badass. What's her strategy? What would be, I mean, I couldn't even, all the complexities of what goes, I mean, I couldn't imagine, like, everyone wants to go different directions.
Stresses me out just saying, you know, going to Disneyland. She takes a stroller that's very easy to fold, so you can just pull up on a little lever and it collapses it, so that when she gets on the tram, not too much fuss with a stroller. She's got 2-year-old strapped to her back. She's got the four-year-old in the stroller. And then Liv and Eden are just walking by themselves.
Wow. And then what? I mean, how do you make the strategy about who does what, where you go? Do you kind of have the game plan ahead of time?
Does have some reason. There are some rides that the lines don't tend to be very long, like Ariel's Grotto, for example, is a good one for lots of kids. They can go pretty much, usually there's no line at all. You can just go straight onto that. So she'd probably start with something like that because they've been in the car for a long time and just to get them kind of primed. My guess is that she won't try to do anything with a really long line, or if she does, it'll just be like one big ride and then the rest is just like small things that don't take a lot of time to get onto.
Well, that's really impressive.
Yep. Go Laura.
Yep, go Laura.
Yes, she is.
If I got to have a wife, I would pick her too.
Hey.
Good choice.
I've made some good decisions in my life.
Yes.
That was one of them. So what's a happy thing in your day?
I'm looking at the beautiful snowy lake. It's a beautiful snowy lake. I took my first big walk on the lake yesterday in the snow. It was just beautiful, powdery, soft. It's not really Miss Lucy.
Is there an announcement like when the lake is safe to walk on? How do you know?
I don't. Maybe they do put some more, but I've wondered that myself because living on it, I look at it every day. And way before things got just to me that seemed frozen, people were out there. I'm thinking, especially because it's been such a mild winter, I'm like, it looks a little iffy. But now it's been long enough. It's been frozen and snowed on top of it. And now there's lots of people out doing things on the lake and riding their bikes on it and building snowmans and running with their dogs. And so.
But you're saying Lucy
loved it. Lucy would run with me out on the lake and run out and she would roll in the snow and she'd burrow her nose in it. And she just loved it. Really, really brought back wonderful memories of her. And she, because she had a double coat, she was just different. She's like a little baby husky or something. very sweet.
It sounds like it's pretty cozy.
It's so cozy, Trenton. Like, I have to send you a picture of what it looks like. This is from my view. I'm recording from my bed.
I've got a hot water bottle. Bed, you got a yes, hot water bottle. And you're looking out on an expanse of snow. Yes. That is the definition of that. Sounds so cozy.
So cozy.
Man, you do such a good job of like making a space.
So into really, cozy. So into cozy, man. You're
really hitting the cozy hard. And I got a lot of respect for that.
It feels so good to do it. And then to delight in it. You know, my mom's the same way. We always talk about this on the podcast. But even with her downsizing into where she's living now, it's been really sweet to watch her transform this tiny, not tiny, but, you know, it's a one bedroom in a, you know, an assisted living. Mm-hmm. And just, it's like, just looks just like her home. It's just so, it looks like a Paris. She's like, it's like a Paris salon, you know, just paintings and textures and it's all one. It's just lovely.
Right. So I imagine like when you or your mom move into a place for the first time, it's like first order of business is making it cozy. Whereas I think for a lot of us, you know, normal non-cozy people, it's like when you move into a space, it's just like, let's get all the boxes in here and then, you know, unpack boxes, stay there for the next 3 years, right?
Right.
And it's just, it seems like that would be like a priority for somebody who is, you know, who makes spaces like this. Like,
it's so simple. Yes. Yeah, there's these simple elements. Like there's two trunks I've kind of kept with me over the years. One's an old Indian bridal trunk and the other one's an old.
An old Indian bridal trunk. You say that, as if that's just like, you know, something people have. Your storage is cozy. Your storage is cozy. Oh my gosh, an old Indian bridal trunk. What
is that? I got it in Bonnie Doon.
Of course you did.
It's like I got it from a woman named Patricia who lived in the tiny cottage that I ended up renting by the lake, the river in Bonnie Doon. By the redwoods, and it's all hand painted tin that's decorative that covers the entire wooden trunk that has, it's just beautiful. I've kind of trashed it over the years, but and gone in and kind of tried to redo the decorative elements with a paint pen, which was not a good choice in dim lighting, but. It's an Indian bridal trunk is so that they, I guess when the bride would be married, she would fit all her belongings in the trunk and move off with her husband. I should look it up for examples.
So this trunk is, that is your primary means of conveyance of your, of your belongings?
No, it's actually, I don't even, no, no, not with me. No, it's just more... you know what it is? It's a cozy stabilizer.
Do you have that out on display?
Yeah, it's where my little treasures kind of go on top of it. And so I have some candelabra and just various little things. And then I have another trunk. Yeah, my dad shipped me 500 pounds of my stuff from Portland a couple of years ago. Yeah. I think I probably did a podcast episode about it. Yeah, and it arrived. And so he sent these trunks and they were full of stuff and then a bunch of other 480 pounds of other stuff. But bottom line is I love taking things that I've had with me over the years and just can make home cozy with a few little elements that mean something to you, and color-wise, work really lovely together. I always find that a crimson color with a rich greeny teal and against wood and so brown and red and blue turquoise. How's your week started off?
Yesterday, not gonna lie to you, a little bit rough yeah. for Monday. Had to give out a couple detentions, which I don't like doing. Today ended on a really high note. Like, it's amazing to me how little appreciation I need to feel awesome. You know what I mean? Like, yeah. I taught a lesson to my middle school kids about shutter speed. We did a project where we stopped motion. And on the way out, one of the kids that, sometimes is a little bit more difficult, he just said, "Thanks for the lesson today." And he rarely do I get any kind of gratitude for the instructional portion of my being a teacher.
Yeah.
And it was just, even now, like, I feel so much lighter, in my heart, because of that one little thanks,
Yeah.
And it was delivered in a sincere way, not just like something you pass off, like, "Thanks, Mr. Reynolds. Bye." He was intentional about being grateful. So that kind of.
That's really great. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. It made my day in a small way. So. Yep.
Like, you should get that a lot. The teenagers aren't the best at that.
Teenagers, it's not their strong point.
Yeah.
So you brought up a topic idea that I thought was really interesting, and we've probably touched on something similar in past conversations, but I think it might be something worth revisiting because of kind of a situation I find myself in my own artwork at the moment. So the topic that you brought up was cohesiveness.
Yeah.
So you are thinking of it in terms of like a book having a certain type of cohesion between all the different pages and between, I'm imagining, the text that's being included in images, et cetera, something like that. Mm-hmm.
My thought was to talk a little bit about cohesiveness. And when I'm thinking about it, one thing I talk a lot about with students is about the cohesiveness within when we're making a book and how we're not just looking at it as a single piece beside another single piece beside another single piece, but we're looking at for the whole experience, which I like to use the metaphor of it as a film. We're looking at the experience of the film. We're not like looking at just this shot by this shot. Sometimes we'll say that's a fantastic scene, that was a fantastic shot, but overall we want to come away with a feeling about the whole film. So that's the way I like to think about a book, an experience of a book.
Right.
So, and then the other side of it's thinking about painting or a collection of doing a collection of work. So that, yeah.
Right. I think there's a very, very direct analog there in painting where you would work in a series and that series would have some kind of through line, or some kind of uniting features or uniting ideas or principles that kind of guided you along. And there's value in that cohesion. It gives you a chance to learn in ways that you wouldn't if you were just making one-off pieces all the time, right? And it kind of reinforces a larger concept by having multiple iterations or multiple perspectives on this one kind of underlying theme or underlying, direction, as it were. So like if you were to create a body of work, and that I think that's what you would call it if in the context of like studio art, you would call it a body of work. And you could have multiple bodies of work, but a body of work would be some multiple pieces that somehow all tie together. And then you'd put it up in a gallery and hopefully, the presentation of all that work together would be greater than any of the individual pieces by itself. There would be some larger gestalt, right? Or some larger effect that was experience.
So for me, one of the things is the feeling of like thinking about it like music too, where you want to have an element of there's a rhythm that's happening through it. but you want to also have a sense of surprise and variation. Mm-hmm. So it's not about making something them all sort of be the same kind of theme and like they're all kind of in the similar color, but you want to have the actually more the interesting thing is to have this pop of color, pop of black coming through, or you want to have I was just talking with a student today who I'm mentoring about, you know, just how you want to have that surprising element happen of where there's maybe there's spaciousness for resting after a certain amount of text you've read. You want to let the whole experience of how your eyes move across a page, turn the page upside down to read something, you know, the pacing of the eyes experience across a spread, and then the experience of the next spread after that, and what you want to have that experience to be. You don't necessarily, even if you're working with something an emotional, you know, emotional text, you want to be mindful of like, okay, after that, do you want to have another spread right after that of emotional text? Maybe it's really more effective to have a spread that's just two beautiful images that have no text at all on them. That's what I'm working with Emily Lumen, who's working on her book, and just the way she's incorporating photography is really a beautiful juxtaposition against the collage work and the spaciousness she leaves in throughout the pacing of the book gives it an overall cohesion, because there's continuity, but also excitement as you experience it, as you go through it. So mm-hmm. that's one thing I'll say. It's a little abstract, but I'm talking with my eyes closed and my hands moving.
No, I think what you're describing is being cognizant of the experience of actually reading the book, right? Of not just the visual information or the text that's in there, but the journey over time of experiencing those things in a you know, in a sequence and over a duration of time.
Right.
A couple things that come to mind when you said that is that I think when you put up a body of work in a gallery or just, you know, in your studio to look at it on the wall, it's often the case where a painting will demand a certain amount of space around it. Like if you put two paintings that are too strong close together, there's this like repulsion that happens. You know, you just feel that painting needing more space to breathe because it's maybe too busy or too just dynamic to be able to have lots of them close together. Whereas another painting that's, you know, maybe more subdued or not, doesn't attack you quite as much visually, could very comfortably sit much closer to another piece. Does that make sense? So being aware of not just of how your viewer is going to be able to interact with the work and putting enough space around it so that they can interact with it without being overloaded or given enough breathing room, I guess, to appreciate it, I think is also an important thing. It's interesting to me to think you were talking about how, you know, being conscious of how maybe one layout is spread out from another, just so you don't put two right next to each other that are like in a gallery, you don't have that spatially, you don't have that control over how your viewer enters in and moves from painting to painting. Mm-hmm. So there's not that same control of you're going to go from this page to the next page. Like there's an obvious sequence there. Whereas I guess it depends on the gallery space, but there perhaps is not as much of control over that. So it therefore is probably just not as much a part of your thought process as you're creating the work. I don't know.
Well, my first thought is to say yes. And then the other part is like, well, wait, there's always the hell. Most people don't open a book from start to finish. They flip through it and they open anywhere. So there is that element of surprise. And so a curator would lay out a gallery space in a way that they'd hope that the people would walk through and experience the space. But there's always people that are going to go backwards through it or go right into the middle
and I guess
miss the first three. And
I guess unlike a book, you could open up to the middle physically, whereas a gallery space, you're going to have to go in by the door. more likely than not, right?
Whereas you but could, yeah, but like, you would still maybe sometimes, like me, I would just walk straight into the middle of the space. I would stop. I wouldn't remember to like necessarily start the gently on the left and start working my way around the room. I'd be like, oh, that painting looks cool over there through the second room, you know. Mm-hmm. As you're talking about a complex piece and having space for it, it's interesting that the more there's more space needed for how complex the piece is in a way.
For sure. For sure. Yeah. Like it doesn't necessarily have to do with how much, like how busy the visual information is. Cause I'm thinking of like a Mark Rothko that is very simple, like rectangles, right? But somehow that kind of requires, well, physically they're large paintings, but they also, more than that, they require like more breathing room. Whereas you could have also have a much smaller piece, like a tiny piece that could require just as much room, or, you know, or vice versa. I don't know. Like, I'm not sure if there's an obvious thing that to point at that where one piece would require, or why one piece would require more space than another. But it does have to do with just how strong the piece is, like strong. I don't know. Is it emotional impact, the strength of,
yeah,
of that?
Yeah. And then do you think that for you, when you think about how do you guys find cohesion as a group of paintings?
That's a good question. And I think you just like, you know, when you create a book, there's probably a lot of there's an intuition you've developed over years of how to unite a whole, you know, body of pages, a whole, you know, series of pages or layouts or spreads.
Right.
But I think to a certain degree, and that's what's kind of interesting to me about where I'm at right now. So I've got three paintings that are all kind of based on this, you know, resin and laser and collage type of abstraction. Right. So there's a similarity. There's something that unites them in terms of the size and dimension of the work, in terms of the materials, and in terms of the application and techniques that I'm using. Right. So that's what unites them, or that's maybe a cohesive element. But I'm feeling like they're all too much the same. Right. So it's, I think, and I'm sure with you as well in books, you want them to have a cohesion. You want them to belong together somehow, but if they're too much the same, it can get stifling, or it can get uninteresting, or they stop having an individual identity, which I think is just as important as having a group identity or a cohesion. Does that make sense?
Yeah.
Like you want the pieces to be different enough that there's a tension and there's a conversation between the pieces, and you want enough sameness or similarity or cohesion. I don't know, you know, what the right word is there, but you want it to be similar enough that they somehow read as a group, you know, and you don't want to have that one piece that is, you know, really different than all the others and just, you know, is an anomaly and sticks out and creates this unwanted tension, you know?
Mm-hmm.
So so there's a couple things that I'm trying to kind of isolate some things to learn from in what has been said, but it seems to me that, and something that's kind of a new thought for me listening to you, is to maybe one of the ways that we can think of cohesion in terms of a book or a body of paintings or artwork is to consider the narrative of a viewer interacting with the work. So a viewer walking into a gallery space, encountering this painting, and what do I want them to experience with that work, or what kind of feeling do I want to evoke? And how is that going to lead them into the next thing they experience? Or how is that going to play off of this other painting that's on the other side of the room that they will encounter? And so thinking in terms of a narrative that you're creating for, or an experience you're creating for a potential viewer, I think that could be a very powerful way to create cohesion, to create some kind of continuity throughout a body of work.
Yeah, absolutely. Beautifully said. It's also that pull, what you pull out, you know, it's like you have this many say this many pages, like to make something cohesive also is about removing what's not absolutely necessary. Mm-hmm. That I think what makes something cohesive is the actual, the what's not there to make the mm-hmm. other stuff sharp into sharper focus.
Man, that is such, how do you teach that though? How do you tell somebody how to do that? Because it's something's belonging or not. I don't know.
I teach it pretty well.
I'm sure.
I do. No, I really feel proud of what I've seen, what's happened. Yeah.
But I guess you have the work in front of you and you can maybe just through comparison and looking at things side by side, be able to deal with it one-on-one. But is there a larger, more general principle there that you could distill and teach people about? Like, how do you know if something belongs in this overall piece?
When I'm looking at people's spreads, so I'm at the stage right now where I'm working with people, was there in their stages of getting these the pages and spreads finished so that they can be put into the formats to be printed. What is really important and what I think is to say, okay, so has this been said already in a different way that's stronger? Has this been evoked in another way stronger than how it's being evoked here? Is there another more exciting way this has been captured? Then there doesn't need to be more of it. You know, there doesn't need to be more of it.
Got it.
Yeah. It's the editorial process, which is just such it's a beautiful art in itself. It's just editing down something. So it's just sharp and clean.
To apply that idea to where I'm at right now with these paintings, mm-hmm. I might be able to look at these three paintings side by side and say, I'm already accomplishing that in this painting in a much more interesting way. So yeah. Perhaps I'd get rid of that in this other painting and use that, or I just remove that painting from the series and try to push in a different direction or try to say something different with an entirely different painting. But I think maybe there's a kind of editorializing that could happen there, or an editing absolutely. Process that can happen there.
Yeah, absolutely.
I can imagine. Yeah. Putting them, if there's a repeated or a pattern, or if there's a repeated color relationship, maybe even just covering it up with a blank piece of paper mm-hmm. and seeing how I feel about it with its absence, you know, does that make sense? And
yep.
Just keeping the part of the composition or part of the painting that does feel fresh and like it's saying something different than the other paintings, keeping that visible, but you know, covering everything else up. I don't know. I can see how that could be really helpful.
Yeah. I like to think about it like when the typical self-published book, the reason it looks self-published is because it's just not absolutely solid and sharp. And it's usually either sort of too much and too much repetition and just not bold and clear and all the elements are just there and confident and strong. Mm-hmm. And that's where you have to take the book to that level. Mm-hmm. So in order to do that, you have to be very confident in the editing process.
Well, yeah, I say that's so hard to do though, especially when mm-hmm. you're so close to the work, because you see all the subtle differences between, I said it this way better
right,
over here,
right, right.
but I'm making a nuanced point over here. So I need to keep that in.
Right.
Really just, you know, just simplifying is the better route to go. It's so hard to do that if you can't get some kind of psychological or emotional distance from the work.
Right.
Can you do that for your own work, or do you need an editor to help you, you know, sort out what needs to go and what needs to stay?
I didn't.
I'm sure you've gotten good at it over time.
Yeah, I did. I love my editing process. I always talk about with Becky Beninate, who edited Spilling Open. I love that collaborative process. It's always helpful to get other people's eyes on it, but working within the limitations of a certain amount of pages that say can be in the book or a certain amount of pieces that can be in the show, I mm-hmm. definitely, again, coming back to restraint, creating restraint.
So having, I think that brings up a good point, is maybe having an editing process built into your built into the system, right? So if you know that you're going to have a show that where you're going to be putting 5 paintings up, plan on making 15 paintings so that there's a built-in process where you're going to necessarily have to edit out some, right? Does that make sense?
Right.
And if it's a book, and making a lot more pages than you actually need, you know, just the parameters of or the limitations of your project force you to be an editor, force you to refine.
Yes.
You know.
Yeah. Yeah.
I mean, a lot of us, I don't think have those built-in editing or limitations where, you know, we have YouTube, we have social media, we can just post everything we create, right? And there's a lot of different avenues in life where there aren't those editing or limitations that require us to edit to accommodate. And I think it's important. I think you bring up a really good point. I mean, so much of this ties into, I think, a lot of hangups like getting too precious about your work, right? Being unwilling to edit because you don't want to let go of what the work needs you to let go of. Ties into fear, ties into you know, all sorts of things. I don't know. I think this is a great topic.
Great combo.
Well done.
What's coming up for you?
Life is coming up, coming fast and furious.
And you're doing a great job, Mr. Reynolds, teaching.
Hey, thanks.
Yeah.
Thanks. I don't think anything particular is on the horizon. I've got some 3D printing stuff that I've been dabbling with and digital sculpting.
Can you post some of it on Instagram, Mo?
I will see if I can.
Yeah.
And I've been working on these laser paintings that I was talking about earlier that feel like they get... I'm at kind of a rut, not quite sure where to go next with them. So,
well, send some pictures of them, or if you want any feedback, I'd like the idea of covering some up with white and just pull the parts where that you really love what's happening.
I'm gonna give that a try. I'll see if I get you some images. What about yourself? What's going on? What's up this week? Besides recovery and lots of tea,
and hot water bottles, and filming, and just excited about, I've got some things that are going to be coming out. I'm going to do some demos. I'm kind of holding myself accountable to do some demos on Facebook, I think.
Awesome.
And I'm gearing up for March, mid to late March. Liberate is going to open for a week for registration, where you can obviously be anywhere in the world to take. But it is a small, limited group. Not totally small, but it will be open until it fills up. But that last year, that was a week, which it won't be more than a week.
Get ready.
Yeah, I'm just excited. I'm excited just to be, I'm really glad to be feeling better. And I hope to everyone out there who has sick kids or they're feeling sick is just getting the cold over and over again. The flu, love and cozy to you.
All right. Well, I'm wishing you and everyone out there a cozy, cozy week. Make it cozy.
Yes. Yes. Absolutely. All right. Talk to you soon. Thanks for listening. We'll be back next week. In the meantime, you can follow us on Instagram at Sabrina Ward Harrison and at Trent Reynolds Art.
And check out the show notes at roominthetrees.com, where you can also get in touch if you have any ideas you'd like to share.
If you like this podcast, please consider showing your support. You can become a subscribing patron at patreon.com/room.
Please help us grow our audience by rating us or writing a review on iTunes. To do that, you can use the link roominthetrees.com/iTunes in any phone or computer internet browser.